Good evening and welcome to Outsources, KGNU's weekly LGBTQ news magazine. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth, and my guest is Dr. Christy Suarez, Assistant Professor of Women and Gender Studies and Co-Director of the LGBTQ Studies Certificate Program at University of Colorado in Boulder. Dr. Suarez is a performance artist who makes political statements in and through the body. As an award-winning teacher, Dr. Suarez encourages students to try out concepts using their bodies. She also uses a philosophy around theater of the oppressed at times. Dr. Suarez is an award-winning published author who has a book under contract and an oral history project that explores Latinx DJs and the development of disco and dance music in the 1970s New York. She has a deep sense of humor. When you look at a few of her book chapters, titles, the articles, or the presentations, I'll just tell you one. The Cuban Missile Crisis of White Masculinity, Tito Bonito, and the Burlesque Butt. That made me laugh. So, Dr. Suarez, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Karen.
I read through your CV and I thought, oh my gosh, this is really an interesting person. So tell us a little bit about how you identify, a little bit more about the person behind all this massive work.
Well, yeah, thank you. So I identify as a lesbian and as queer, have for a long time. More recently, I've started using the language of non-binary and genderqueer. So I've started using they pronouns in addition to she pronouns. So, you know, I've been in touch with my sexuality for a long time. And as a professor of women and gender studies and LGBTQ studies, I am intellectually engaged with the project of gender, but I'm starting to explore what that might mean for me personally.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I noticed is that one of your CVs is that you're native to three languages and a fourth very advanced. So tell me about that.
Oh, my mother will be so glad that you asked about that.
I'm glad. Oh, mom is listening.
Well, I grew up in Miami. My mother is Cuban. My father is Brazilian. So I grew up speaking English, Spanish, and Portuguese. Portuguese is my first language. And then when I was really young, my mother put me in French classes, and I studied French for forever. So my French is a little rusty, but I did at one time speak fluently. Mm. And yeah, language is very important to me. A lot of my work, my research is bilingual. I'm often doing community engaged projects that are in touch with communities, particularly here in Colorado, Latinx communities that are Spanish speaking. I wish everyone could speak a lot of languages. I think it's a way to sort of travel linguistically.
I think that the language carries culture and you learn a lot about other people and
exactly.
Other lands by just learning their grammar and their vocabulary.
Yeah.
I also think that it's incredible how many languages that you learn, given how monolingual the U.S. is, and that you survived being able to do all those languages. But it enabled you to get a doctorate in comparative lit.
Yeah, it's true.
Which you have to have multiple languages.
That's true, yeah.
To get a doctorate in that discipline. So it's very unique and amazing of what you have been able to accomplish just in terms of language and,
thank you.
And your doctorate. Impressive. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've been working on. I know you have this book that's you've been working on for quite a while and during COVID, and sounds like you've finished it up and it's under contract and
it's true.
About to be launched.
That's true, yeah. So my book is called Playful Protests, The Political Work of Joy in Latinx Media, and it'll come out through University of Illinois Press, their Feminist Media Studies series in October of 2023. I'm really proud of it. Some version of it, some kernel of it was my dissertation when I was in grad school, and throughout the years, various jobs, moving all around the United States, it's sort of developed into the project that it is today, which is basically a project that looks at why joy matters when doing social justice and political work. And it uses the case study of Cuban and Puerto Rican media produced within the United States in the diaspora to sort of look at the ways that joy makes meaning. It's not frivolous. It's not beside the point. It's exactly the point, I think.
Mm-hmm. Tell me a bit about how this works, because people get very serious about politics and about political protest, and the issues are high stakes often, and people's lives are in the balance. And I think that was the very first thing that made me say, I need to interview this person. because we get so serious and down and mm-hmm. depressed and discouraged and angry and scream at each other and lose friends and family over sure. some of the political change that we think we all need. So tell me about joy and play in all of this.
Sure. Well, I think there's room for all of that. I mean, we should be angry in the face of injustice. We should yell so that we're heard. I think that is all part of the experience of being an activist. But there are other things that are part of it too. And what sort of happened in the way that we academics and social justice folks tell the story of activism is that we're only telling one part of it. We're telling the part where we're at the protest and we're yelling and we're screaming and we're marching, but we're not telling the part about the car ride home where we're saying, did you see that person's outfit? Do you want to go get some food? You know, activism can be a lot of fun. It has to be, or else we would have stopped it years ago. Uh-huh. So I think this is just a rounding out of the way we talk about activism, just paying attention to something that makes it sustainable. And joy is one of the things I think that makes activism sustainable, particularly in a world that is as sad and scary as the world we're living in today. And when I look specifically at the Cuban and Puerto Rican examples in those cultural contexts, it's really obvious. It's really obvious that people will do things like dance at a protest. And that's not considered beside the point. It's a way to pass the time. Protests are long sometimes. Mm-hmm. They're tiring. Your feet hurt. Mm-hmm. So sometimes dancing can help you keep going for longer.
Mm-hmm. Several years ago, I was in Oaxaca. And the teachers were protesting the lack of library materials in their schools. And I was shocked how much they were using poetry and spoken word. And they had sewn banners that were gorgeous. And I thought, this is really marrying the arts with the protest. And there was a lot of joy in what I saw. In the teachers, and very strong poetry and very serious intention, and really over just wanting some library books, please. But they were very serious and dedicated, and they camped out on the plaza at the Capitol in Oaxaca for just about a week.
Wow.
And got what they wanted, but you know, that was really dedicated and beautiful mm-hmm. and very like, we don't do it like that too much.
Yeah. Well, and if we think about sewing the banner, that probably took a really long time. Maybe they were watching TV while they were doing it together. Mm-hmm. Maybe they were laughing. That's activism too, right? Mm-hmm. We know that it's not just the public performance. It's all the parts. My work looks a lot at media, so at songs that have political meaning. And a lot of times they're upbeat. You know, and that's a part of the legacy too. So I think it's just important to kind of complicate it, especially in moments when people feel so hopeless, and there's reason to feel hopeless. I too feel hopeless some days, mm-hmm. but not every moment is hopeless. And we just need a sort of a retraining to pay attention to those other moments that are part of our activist practice as well.
Mm-hmm. So how do we do that?
That's a great question. I think that we can pay attention to our emotions and activism. And this is something that the public conversation has gotten so much more robust in maybe the last 10 years. Some of the work that I do goes back. The book deals with media from the 1960s to the present. So I look, for example, at the New York-based Young Lords Party. Mm-hmm. And the Young Lords Party, they were Puerto Rican revolutionary nationalists. They were looking for a sovereign Puerto Rican state, self-determination for the Puerto Rican people. And they were doing so in the face of astonishing policing by the New York City police, food insecurity. I mean, just the worst possible economic and social conditions. And the truth is that their external performances often mirrored that. Of course, you have to sometimes march outside of a jail when one of your comrades is unjustly imprisoned inside. But also, there is a lot of joy in the record. We find, for example, records of music playing at their protests. And this is something that folks just haven't thought to write about. It was there, but that's just not what people focused on. They focused on the words that were being said, not the music on the background. So when we kind of explore that, we see that they didn't have to do anything. They were just sort of rounding it out. Someone said, let's hey, what if we play some music while we're waiting for things to get set up? And I think contemporary activist groups are just great contemporary activists at talking about emotions, at naming, I'm angry. What I'm saying now is coming from a place of anger. And that allows us to say, like, I'm happy. And it's okay for me to be happy right now. And it's okay for me to be mad 2 minutes from now. And naming that, I think, can be really, really, it can transform your activism. We're not machines. We're people with a lot of investment in the actions that we're fighting for.
Well, and it also lets people be more who they are, you know, to be fully who they are. That they're not mad all the time, and they're not angry. They're not loud. Sometimes they're quiet or very sweet, thoughtful. Just a lot of different emotions that we can have, and being able to allow yourself. Because also, it takes a lot of energy to be out there, and you need nurturing time for each other and for yourself, and gentleness and quiet and sleep.
Right.
Your mom would say, you got to eat, you got to sleep.
Yeah, it's true. And we know this. I mean, of course, human beings have always known this, but when you're in the struggle, it can feel, and sometimes is, life or death. It can feel immediate. So... yeah, it's hard. It's hard to remember those things. You know it. I know it. We've all been there and pushed ourselves too far, which is why I think looking at historical and contemporary models of how people complicate what activism is and how it gets done, I think that can kind of give us permission. Like if Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez can joke around in her social media, that's one of the things I study in my book, then I can joke around. Mm-hmm. She's getting a lot done. Well, she's trying to get a lot done. And so it's okay.
Well, she's lifting up a lot of issues. Whether they get resolved or not depends on whether she's hit the brick wall up there. But she's pointing out a lot of things that people have been aware of for a long time that seem to be like the elephant in the room that we're pretending away. And she's raising it.
Yeah.
And in different ways.
Yeah. And she gets death threats all the time. So I can only imagine what I would have to do to feel okay if my work meant that I was under threat all the time. And for her, part of that practice is her social media presence, particularly Instagram, is hilarious. It's really funny. I think that's part of her activism.
And it sounds like part of permission, too.
Yeah.
Let's be strong and let's laugh and have a good time and support each other in multiple ways that we can. If you're just joining us, this is Outsources, KGNU's weekly LGBTQ magazine. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. My guest is Dr. Christy Suarez, Assistant Professor of Gender and Women's Studies and co-director of the LGBTQ Certificate Program at CU Boulder, a performance artist, an award-winning writer and teacher, and way more. Here you are at CU Boulder. That's a very white university with a mainly white campus and a white town, predominantly white state. So how do you work with your students? What's different about your classes?
I think my classes, first of all, they follow the same principles as activism. So if you want to get something done as an activist, you have to build community. You have to find a way to support each other. You have to find a way to draw boundaries and state them clearly and have them be respected. You have to be allowed to come and go. You have to be allowed to think creatively. You have to be allowed to be loud sometimes and quiet other times. All the things we've already been talking about. And some of the pedagogical choices that I make in my classes are really designed around that. And there are philosophies. I sometimes use exercises from Theater of the Oppressed, which thinks deeply about power.
Could you give listeners some examples of that? Because some people don't know what Theater of the Oppressed is.
Sure. Well, Theater of the Oppressed is a Brazilian theater tradition. And the goal was that theater is a rehearsal for the revolution. And that's a quote from the creator, Augusto Boal. And the idea is that you can actually practice the revolution through theater, and then you'll be more prepared for the revolution. But we can even add on to that, that theater itself can be the revolution. There can be something revolutionary about theater. And in the case of my classes, you know, sometimes we'll do embodied exercises where I'll ask them to pay attention to how they feel. Do they feel comfortable or uncomfortable? And we'll do, for example, a Theater of the Oppressed exercise where you pantomime having a ball. And then I'll say, as the joker or the leader, okay, please throw your ball to someone else. And that's funny because I didn't tell you who to throw it to, and there are 40 people in the room, and it's chaos, and did I catch a ball? So we debrief. The point is not so much the exercise as debriefing. How did that feel? Did you feel uncomfortable? Did you feel comfortable? Were there moments where you felt more or less like you knew what was going on? How did that make you feel? And the whole point is to talk about power. The people mm-hmm. who feel comfortable throughout that entire exercise are people who feel comfortable in the space of an educational classroom. They oftentimes have white identities. They mm-hmm. oftentimes are not afraid of failure because they don't think it will reflect badly on their race mm-hmm. or gender or sexuality. So in kind of deconstructing that and putting it out on the table, you can slowly model new power relations. And it's incomplete, and it doesn't always work, and it doesn't always work for everyone. But I do think it models how we go about creating another world mm-hmm. Together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In terms of creating another world, do you see the certificate program? You're now co-director. Do you see that going in a new direction? Or
I do.
Or what are your hopes to maybe in a leadership role kind of guide it in a new direction?
Yeah, my hope would be that the current certificate program in LGBTQ studies at CU Boulder would become something bigger. I think that we're in a moment as LGBTQ people plus people where we have to decide whether we want to get bigger or shrink down. There's no staying the same. We're under siege.
Mm-hmm.
Also, wonderful things happen, right? It's always like that. As good as the good is, the bad it matches it. Mm-hmm. Things are extreme. So I don't think there's any sitting still. I don't think that's an option mm-hmm. for us. Election that just passed included some pretty nasty rhetoric. We can't just sit quietly. We have to get bigger or decide to go home. And for me, I think we have to get bigger. We're really lucky that I think we have a lot of alums and community activists who want to help us to be something bigger. And I think the future is a center maybe for queer and trans studies that is a leader in the Rocky Mountain West. There's no reason we shouldn't be the number one center for discussing queer and trans issues in the Rocky Mountain West.
That sounds pretty exciting. We just need funding.
I think we can get it. You know, queer and trans people are pretty resilient and pretty resourceful. It uh-huh. had to be.
So that's something out there on the horizon that sounds good. How has all the work you've done and the things that you've learned as a professor, a writer, a performance artist, how has that helped you deal with some of the latest ups and downs? I mean, the Congress is passing marriage equality, but we have a case coming up in the Supreme Court, and who knows what they'll do with that. And of course, the latest tragedy of Club Q and the murders there. How does some of what you've learned in your life and in your work helped you, and how does that help you work with the students and your family and friends and community?
I mean, it's really hard. It's really hard for all of us. I think it would be disingenuous to act like we figured out how to navigate mass trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Perpetuated again and again and again and again. I have found community with my students in my queer theory class, talking about it, sitting with it, acknowledging it. Certainly that helps. But I think in the same way that sometimes we have to pull back a little bit in winter, it's dark, it's cold, it's a time to sort of get your energy up.
Mm-hmm.
I find myself doing that right now. I think this is a time that's really intense and the fight is long and we owe it to each other not to burn out. So my process right now is just trying to figure out how to make activism in this political moment sustainable for me. And it's definitely a process. I'm trying to learn it every day. Do you have any tips?
Well, one thing that I learned from Amendment 2 many years ago was that it is easy to keep going and going and going and going and fall flat for a while, and that I learned it's very, very important to be clear on how to be out in the lead and how to drop back and not quit, but have others take the lead for a while so you can rest and you can gather yourself like you talk about. You can do that in the winter or you can do that whenever. It feels like when you're under stress, you know, like there's an election coming and people are going to decide one way or the other and you don't get the luxury to do that. But are there ways to have moments of rest or moments to you step back where you just let it go? And like you say, put on some fun music, good food, surround yourself with people that love you, get away from the toxicity of the dreck that's been spewed your way, control the amount of debris coming your way. I mean, that's true of, I would say, I learned from Columbine when that murder happened, and or any of things, 9/11, anything, where if you just keep consuming media that's toxic, it'll make you sick. So it's not to shut it off, but have things in manageable packets that you can take in, learn, understand, take moments away. So those are some of the things that I learned over time that it's not a sprint.
Yeah, it's not a sprint.
And
yeah,
it's beyond a marathon, actually. I would add, if you're lucky to get old, you know?
Yeah.
So you want to think about long term. How do you keep going over the years? Because it isn't of, okay, we did it, one done. If nothing else has taught us that, the Supremes have taught us that. I hate to say it. I wish there was another lesson they might be teaching us, but that's one of them. That seems clear to me.
Yeah.
How would you advise some of your students and some of the community members at this point for you, you know, of like, how do we get through all these things that are, like you say, there's highs and fun and there's terrible lows, and that doesn't even figure in anything that just goes on in people's lives personally.
Right.
The ups and downs of those things of around health and love and family and birth and death. And that's, you know, that's regular life.
Right.
And then there's all this other stuff.
Yeah. I guess I'd say that. So I always turn to our foremothers because, you know, I haven't been on this earth that long and I've only learned what I've learned in 38 years. And, you know, and there's so much more. And so oftentimes I'll go back and I'll read, particularly Audre Lorde. And Audre Lorde, when she's dying and she writes the Cancer Diaries, what I love about that book is that it's everything. It's enraged, it's joyful, it's sad, it's all the feelings. And I think I sort of come back to that's all we can do. All we can do is be honest about what's going on, feel it, and then tomorrow we feel something different. So I think that's what we can do is show up with each other in person, or you can be present even on digital mediums, over the phone, over text. You can have extreme presence and just feel what's going on. And that's really scary when it's something like a shooting. It's really scary to allow that pain in. So sometimes it's easier to do that in community if that's something that feels comfortable for you.
Yeah, and if you're around where there is community, obviously, which that is one good thing about our social media and some of the things we've used more in COVID to be able to find ways to connect. But the eyeball-to-eyeball is still stronger.
I want to plug an artist project that recently was sent to me, and it's LBAR, LBAR.co. And it's this artist that has recreated lesbian bars from 1925 to the present that have shut down through oral histories by getting photographs.
Oh,
and
wow.
You can digitally move through the rooms of these different lesbian bars all around the world. And other people can too. And you can have your camera on if you want. And you can be in physical space that's digital in these lesbian bars that no longer exist with people. My students and I did it yesterday. And we were in a classroom together physically, but we were also all on our computers digitally in this room together. And it was magical.
So it's like virtual reality in a way.
Kind of.
It sounds like.
Yeah, you don't need a VR headset. Mm-hmm. You can just do it on your computer. But it's pretty magical because it felt like we were somewhere. We were in these lesbian bars, some of which we would have never had the chance to go to. Mm-hmm. They stopped existing in the 1930s.
Yes, many of which actually don't exist? I mean, the number of lesbian bars now versus when I was younger is dramatically reduced, as far as I can tell.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we have to find ways to find each other. This is one. I'm sure there are a million others, but that's really special to create spaces, even if they are digital, where where people can feel together. That's really special.
Are there other things like LBAR that you have come across that you think listeners should know about as a nice resource or for fun or getting through life right now?
Well, lately I've been on Instagram. I've been following this account, Trans Guys Supply. They sell clothing and accessories for trans men, but they're more than that. They have photos of trans men experiencing joy, cuddling, laughing. And even though I'm not technically in the room with those people, I don't know who runs the account. I don't own any of their clothing. I feel a part of something when I'm on that account. And social media does a lot of bad, but it does a lot of good too. And that's an example, I think.
That's a great example.
Yeah.
Of, again, things can be used for good or bad.
Yeah.
Other things you want to tell listeners before we go, as we're kind of wrapping up? There was just so many things we're, I obviously need to have you come back at some point. Anything for now that you would like to leave them with?
Well, they can go to lgbtq.colorado.edu, I think, if I got it right. And there are some great resources for dealing with the aftermath of the shooting. We have a banner at the top of our page with mental health resources, including a link to mental health providers that are giving free counseling right now for LGBTQ plus people. So I would do that. And other than that, I always like to say, I don't know what the average age of your listenership is, but I always like to tell people who don't get the privilege of being around young people all the time that they're amazing and they are so much smarter than I was at their age and so much wiser. And I feel, against all odds, tremendously hopeful for our futures. It won't be easy, and we have not given them what they need to succeed, but they're wonderful leaders. And as someone that gets the privilege of teaching them, I feel extremely comfortable with the idea of stepping away from activism one day, because I know it's going to be okay.
Because you can see it.
Yeah.
It's coming. It's continuing to come along.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Outsources with Dr. Christy Suarez. Join Outsources every Monday night at 6:30 on KGNU Radio or streaming on your computer. Or listen anytime to any of our shows on the KGNU archives or at the news blog, news.kgnu.org/outsources. I'm your host, Karen Rayforth. Be sure to give yourself a hug. And as Essa Campbell always says, take care of your blessings. Good evening.